Hello, and welcome to this week's Science Podcast. I'm producer Giselle Grayson.
And I'm editor Alison Richards. This week, well, I've got some really cool things. We've got a robot going under a glacier and scientists who study the genome of lice for a living.
Well, we also have a podcast plant package, mostly because I love alliteration. We will look at basil blight and we will turn to a Supreme Court ruling about alfalfa. Wait, is that the stuff my mom used to put in sandwiches?
Yeah, and I bet she made them with whole wheat bread as well.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Yeah.
Alfalfa's good stuff. It's chock full of protein and fiber, and most of it's grown actually to feed dairy cattle. It's a huge commercial crop.
I can't wait to see how the Supreme Court got mixed up with that one.
Well, we'll get to that, but I wanted to start first with a story from West Antarctica. Just really cool, although like so much that's cool in science, it's also a bit worrying because it's the ice down in Antarctica that represents the threat to sea level. If the ice down there melts, that's what's going to lead to sea level rise around the world. Now, some scientists noticed that about 30 years ago, at least one glacier down there had suddenly started melting way more quickly than it had been before. And they couldn't figure out why. They sent a robot down, it got lost and didn't come back. They tried again. Now, a plucky little robot actually made it several times, and it brought back some really amazing information. Nell Greenfield Boyce found the story, and she's going to tell us about it.
Last year, a team of researchers took a ship from the southern end of Chile and spent about 2 weeks traveling to reach Pine Island Glacier. This glacier flows down off the West Antarctic ice sheet into the sea. It's been flowing down faster over the last few decades, which means more ice is melting, and scientists are not sure why. Pierre Dutrieux is with the British Antarctic Survey. He says where the glacier hits the sea, there's a vast wall of ice.
So the face of the glacier that is apparent to us when we're on the boat is 50 meters high.
So like 150 feet.
Right.
Below the water is more ice. It's ice for about a quarter of a mile down. Under all this is where the scientists plan to send a robot.
It does look like a little yellow submarine, I would say, actually.
Dutrieux says this yellow submarine is a little over 20 feet long. No people sit inside. There's just sensors to do things like map the ice above and the seafloor below. When it's under the ice, the sub can't communicate with the boat.
You just give it its mission and send it on its way. And then you wait something like 24 hours, depending on the length of the mission. And during that time, you have nothing else to do but to stress, really.
He says a few years ago, during the first attempts to send a robot sub under Antarctic ice, that sub just disappeared and never returned. This time around, the yellow submarine did almost get trapped on one of its missions, but it always managed to come back. All in all, the robot roamed for more than 300 miles beneath a huge shelf of floating ice. And it discovered something, a small mountain range coming up from the seafloor.
So we were very surprised to discover this ridge. It was very exciting, actually.
Dutrieux says he and his colleagues had expected the seafloor to be flat. They realized that this ridge could help explain why Pine Island Glacier is now melting so quickly. In the past, the glacier actually sat on top of this ridge. The ridge acted as a speed bump to slow the slide of ice into the sea. But in recent decades, the ice melted enough that it lifted off the ridge. Warm ocean water then crept in and started eating away at the underside of the glacier, making it melt even faster. These results are reported in the journal Nature Geoscience.
This is a really important step forward.
Richard Alley is a glacier researcher at Penn State University. He says the robot sub's work is a technological tour de force. And he says this glacier is a test case for understanding what could happen to other West Antarctic glaciers in the future. He says when it comes to rising sea levels, Pine Island Glacier itself isn't a huge danger.
The fact that it's gone over this bump is not the end of the world there, probably.
But, he says, neighboring glaciers pose a bigger threat.
The biggest worry is probably the next one over, which is Thwaites. If all of Thwaites were to go, it would make a notable difference to sea level rise.
He says Thwaites Glacier is currently sitting on top of its own speed bump on the seafloor. So this robot sub's discoveries should help scientists understand what could happen if that ever changes. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
We all live in a yellow submarine, yellow submarine.
Well, that is interesting. And Allison, only you could say plucky on the air. I don't think it would sound right if I said it. anyway, our next story is about a louse.
Well, not the sort that you worry about because you've got kids. It's not about the lice that go in your hair. And it's not about my jerk of an ex either. But these are body lice we're talking about, and they're not just extremely itchy, they can also spread serious disease. And scientists thought, well, if we find out what they're made up of, what their DNA is, maybe we'll find a new way to get rid of them. And they've done this complete genome sequence, and Joe Palka reports that it revealed some really unexpected things.
Before we get into the genetics, let's go over a little basic louse biology. First of all, without you and me, there would be no human body louse.
It absolutely has to have the human host in order to survive.
That's Barry Pittendry, a louse geneticist at the University of Illinois. I reached him in Turkey, where he had just finished attending the 4th International Congress on Theroptera. Theroptera is the technical name for lice, and if you can spell that word, you've probably won a spelling bee at some point in your life. Anyways, as Pittendry says, body lice can only survive on a human being. They get most of their nutrients from human blood. Most, but not all. They don't get vitamin B5. For that, they have to rely on a bacterial endosymbiont. And before you can say, can I have a definition, please, an endosymbiont is an organism that lives inside another organism and helps it out.
So in the absence of this endosymbiont, the body louse does not get the vitamins it needs to survive.
So a louse with a healthy endosymbiont and access to your blood is a happy louse. Human lice come in two varieties, head lice and body lice. Head lice are an itchy pain, but otherwise largely harmless. Body lice can spread disease.
Things like relapsing fever and epidemic typhus and trench fever that have killed, you know, millions and millions of people.
That's John Clark of the University of Massachusetts. A few years ago, he and Pittendry decided it would be a good idea to learn more about the louse genome. So they sent some louse DNA to a colleague in Texas.
And he called us back all excited because the genome turned out to be 108 megabases, which is enormously small.
About a third the size of a bumblebee genome. And yes, lice are insects. Now, as they report in the journal PNAS, they have the complete sequence of all the letters of DNA that make up the louse genome. Mary Barenbaum is also a louse geneticist. She says the louse genome has a mere 11,000 genes. And there's a reason lice can make do with so few genes.
Over their evolutionary association with humans, they've had sort of a cushy existence.
Since they live on us, they don't have to hunt for food. It's right under their feet. So the louse genome is missing a lot of the genes other insects use to sense their environments. They're also missing a lot of genes to break down toxins.
There's only a dozen of these genes that deal with toxins, which is half of what honeybees have and a third of what the fruit fly has.
And Barenbaum says there's a good reason for that, too. Human blood doesn't have many toxins.
They don't need an elaborate system for breaking down chemical poisons because over their evolutionary association with humans, they haven't had to deal with them until relatively recently.
But now the poor dear lice have to deal with the chemical poisons we use to try to kill them off. It could get even worse for lice in the future. Barenbaum says the genome sequence may suggest new ways to kill them off. Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
Sounds like some bad news coming up for lice there. And I'm afraid that's not the only bad news we have this week.
Uh-oh. Are you going to talk about the dreaded basil blight?
Well, I'm afraid I am, except, of course, I call it basil blight.
Of course.
but either way, it's a fatal fungal disease called downy mildew. It's been attacking basil plants in New York and Florida and turning all those lovely green leaves a horrible shade of brown and yellow and grey. And of course, the worry is it's going to spread beyond New York and Florida. So, given that we at NPR love our bowls of pasta and pesto, we decided to try and find out what's going on and whether there's anything we can do about it. Michelle Norris called up Margaret McGrath, who's an associate professor of plant pathology at Cornell University.
How bad is this?
It's bad because it wipes the leaves right out, and that's what you want to use. And it can go pretty darn fast. And it's like a couple other new diseases or diseases that we've had that have changed, the late blight in tomatoes, downy mildew in cucurbits. We kind of refer to them as community diseases because they move so easily. So if you have it in your garden, you can affect other gardeners and farmers because the pathogen can just jump onto their crops and plants.
How widespread is it? We know that it's in New York and Florida. Is that just where it's been spotted? Is it suspected to be in other states as well?
It's been found in a couple other states already. Ohio is another one that's been seen this year, New Jersey. What is happening is it was first found in the U.S. in 2007 in the fall in Florida. As I mentioned before, the spores can move very easily in the wind. They can then move from Florida on up the coast and through to other places where basil is being grown.
Now, if people are listening in their cars, I have a feeling that the first thing they do when they go home is going to be go straight to the garden to check their basil plants. If people are listening at home, they're long gone. They're probably headed out there right now. What are the signs that a basil plant might be infected? What do you look for if you're worried about this?
On the top side of the leaf, you're going to see yellowing. And it may be very nondescript. To really know what you have, you have to flip the leaves over, and that's where you'll see the pathogen is on the underside of the leaves.
What's it look
you'll
like?
You'll see a grayish, almost purplish, dusty growth on the underside, sometimes turning to almost black. And that is all the pathogen spores. And then the wind will pick those up and blow them off, and the disease just keeps multiplying like crazy.
So what do you do if you find this on one of your or two of your leaves? What do you, when you find this, do you have to remove the leaf or remove the plant?
In this situation, you could just get rid of the leaves, but realize that as you're disturbing those leaves, the spores are getting knocked around, and they're probably going to end up on other leaves of the plants. When I've had outbreaks, particularly last year when I first saw it, which was the beginning of August, I looked at my husband and I said, we're not waiting until September when we normally make pesto. Get the machine out. We're making pesto now. And we just harvested everything out of the garden and made pesto. And that was that.
If you have to harvest all of your basil all at once, and I guess do what you had to do is whip up a whole bunch of pesto, how do you store it? Do you put it in little ice cube trays and throw it in the freezer?
We make pesto balls, so we put it into little sandwich bags and freezer away.
Good advice.
But it's not the same as a fresh leaf. Not the same.
Nothing is like a fresh leaf.
Absolutely.
Well, Margaret McGrath, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for your time.
You are welcome. Thank you very much.
Come back and join us again.
I'd love to.
Margaret McGrath is an associate professor of plant pathology at Cornell University.
And now the second part of our plant package, alfalfa. On Monday, June 21st, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of Monsanto. They make Roundup Ready alfalfa. And Allison, I'm going to turn it back to you to explain alfalfa again.
Well, it's the Roundup Ready bit that's the bit that changes. Monsanto has genetically modified the alfalfa plant so that it's resistant to the herbicide Roundup. In effect, it means a farmer plants a field of alfalfa that's got this modification, spray all the other weeds with the herbicide Roundup, and the alfalfa's fine. The ruling overturned a lower court that had banned the planting of this Roundup-ready alfalfa. But as reporter Frank Morris discovered, farmers can't start planting the Roundup-ready variety yet.
Monsanto engineered its Roundup-ready alfalfa to stand up to its powerful herbicide. A seed company in Idaho sued the USDA, arguing the agency signed off on it without looking closely at what the plant might do to the environment. A district court agreed and banned the stuff. Yesterday, the Supreme Court lifted that injunction, sent the case back down to a lower court, and all but plowed the fields for farmers who want to plant the Roundup-ready alfalfa, according to Monsanto's David Snively.
I think the high court sided with Monsanto in the alfalfa case, and farmers got the green light to have the USDA regulate whether or not they can go forward with this important biotech crop.
Snively says the 7-1 decision made it clear the lower court was wrong to ban genetically modified alfalfa the way it did. But the Supreme Court stopped short of lifting the ban. Monsanto can't sell its genetically engineered alfalfa until the USDA decides it can. First, the USDA will have to finalize its environmental impact statement. George Kimbrell with the Center for Food Safety says that would be a bad idea. He argues that the genetically modified forage would spread like kudzu.
Alfalfa is open-pollinated, so bees transport the pollen, among other things, and bees don't read signs. Bees don't know which field is genetically engineered and which field is natural or conventional.
He fears genetically modified alfalfa could become an herbicide-resistant superweed. But the USDA has already concluded that GMO alfalfa is not a serious threat. So unless lower courts intercede, the agency will likely finalize that assessment in time for spring planting. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
And that's it for this week's podcast. Next week, we'll probably have that toad counting story I mentioned last week.
And the science desk at NPR has a lot going on. As well as toads, we have a big summer series coming up called The Human Edge. So look out for some stories explaining how evolution gave humans the bodies and minds that got us where we are today. And in the meantime, you can catch all the science news at npr.org/science. That's all from me, Alison Richards.
And I'm Giselle Grayson. Have a great day.